we do not scatter from Babylon. We hide in a cyclone cellar. This thought restored him. Cyclones pass. Who is in charge of the food? He asked. We must ration ourselves from the start.
Rebecca heaved a sigh of relief. The rabbi was at his worst in the wide oscillations, too emotional or too intellectual. He had himself in hand once more. He would become intellectual next. That would have to be dampened, too. Bene Gesserit awareness gave her a new view of the people around her.
Her Jewish susceptibility. Look at the intellectuals.
It was a thought peculiar to the sisterhood. The drawbacks of anyone placing considerable reliance on intellectual achievements were large. She could not deny all of that evidence from the Lampadus hoard. Speaker paraded it for her whenever she wavered. Rebecca had come almost to enjoy the pursuit of memory fancies as she thought of them. Knowing earlier times forced her to deny her own earlier times. She had been required to believe so many things she now knew were nonsense, myths and chimera, impulses of extremely childish behavior.
Our gods must mature as we mature.
Rebecca suppressed a smile. Speaker did that to her often, a little nudge in the ribs from someone who knew you would appreciate it. Joshua had gone back to his instruments. She saw that someone was reviewing the catalogue of food stores. The rabbi watched this with his normal intensity. Others had rolled themselves into blankets and were sleeping on the cots in the darkened end of the chamber. Seeing all of this, Rebecca knew what her function must be.
Keep us from boredom. The games, master? Unless you have something better to suggest, don't try to tell me about my own people, speaker.
Whatever else she might say about these inner conversations, there was no doubt that all of the pieces were connected. The past with this room with her projections of consequences. And that was a great gift from the Bene Gesserit.
Do not think of the future. Predestination? Then what happens to the freedom you are given at birth?
Rebecca looked at her own birth in a new light. It had embarked her on movement toward an unknown destiny, fraught with unseen perils and joys. So they had come around a bend in the river and found attackers. The next bend might reveal a cataract or a stretch of peaceful beauty, and here lay the magical enticement of prescience, the lure to which Muad'Dib and his tyrant son had succumbed.
The oracle knows what is to come.
The Horde of Lampadas had taught her not to seek oracles. The known could beleaguer her more than the unknown. The sweetness of the new lay in its surprises. Could the rabbi see it?
Who will tell us what happens next? He asks. Is that what you want, Rabbi? You will not like what you hear, I guarantee it. From the moment the oracle speaks, your future becomes identical to your past. How you would wail in your boredom. Nothing new. Not ever. Everything old in that one instant of revelation. But this is not what I wanted, I can hear you saying it. No brutality, no savagery. No quiet happiness nor exploding joy can come upon you unexpectedly. Like a runaway tube train in its wormhole, your life will speed through to its final moment of confrontation. Like a moth in the car, you will beat your wings against the sides and ask fate to let you out. Let the tube undergo a magical change of direction. Let something new happen. Don't let the terrible things I have seen come to pass.
Abruptly, she saw that this must have been Muad'Dib's travail. To whom had he muttered his prayers?
Rebecca!
It was the rabbi calling her. She went to where he stood beside Joshua now, looking at the dark world outside of their chamber as it was revealed in the small projection above Joshua's instruments.
There is a storm coming, the rabbi said. Joshua thinks it will make a cement of the ash pit.
That is good, she said. It is why we built here and left the cover off the pit when we entered.
But how do we get out?
We have tools for that, she said. And even without tools, there's always our hands.
A major concept guides the Missionaria Protectiva, purposeful instruction of the masses. This is firmly seated in our belief that the aim of argument should be to change the nature of truth. In such matters, we prefer the use of power rather than force. The Coda. To Duncan Idaho, life in the no-ship had taken on the air of a peculiar game since the advent of his vision and insights into honored Matre behavior. Entry of Teg into the game was a deceptive move, not just the introduction of another player. He stood beside his console this morning and recognized elements of this game parallel to his own Gola childhood at the Bene Gesserit Keep on Gamu, with the aging Bashar as weapons master guardian. Education. That had been a primary concern then, as it was now, and the guards, mostly unobtrusive in the no-ship, but always there as they had been on Gamu. Or their spy devices present, artfully camouflaged and blended into the decor. He had become an adept at evading them on Gamu. Here, with Shiana's help, he had raised evasion to a fine art. Activity around him was reduced to low background. Guards carried no weapons. But they were mostly reverend mothers with a few senior acolytes. They would not believe they needed weapons. Some things in the no-ship contributed to an illusion of freedom, chiefly its size and complexity. The ship was large. How large he could not determine, but he had access to many floors and to corridors that ran for more than 1,000 paces. Tubes and tunnels, access piping that conveyed him in suspensor pods, drop chutes and lifts, conventional hallways and wide corridors with hatches that hissed open at a touch or remained sealed. Forbidden. All of it was a place to lock in memory, becoming there his own turf, private to him in a way far different from what it was to guards. The energy required to bring the ship down to the planet and maintain it spoke of a major commitment. The Sisterhood could not count the cost in any ordinary way. The Comptroller of the Bene Gesserit Treasury did not deal merely in monetary counters. Not for them the solar, or comparable currencies. They banked on their people, on food, on payments due sometimes for millennia, payments often in kind, both materials and loyalties. Pay up, Duncan, we're calling in your note. This ship was not just a prison. He had considered several Mentat projections. Prime. It was a laboratory where Reverend Mothers sought a way to nullify a no-ship's ability to confuse human senses. A no-ship game board. Puzzle and Warren. All to confine 3 prisoners? No. There had to be other reasons. The game had secret rules, some he could only guess, but he had found it reassuring when Shiana entered into the spirit of it. I knew she would have her own plans. Obvious when she began practicing honored Matre techniques, polishing my trainees. Shiana wanted intimate information about Mabella and much more. His memories of people he had known in his many lives, especially memories of the tyrant. And I want information about the Bene Gesserit. The Sisterhood kept him in minimal activity, frustrating him to increase Mentat abilities. He was not at the heart of that larger problem he sensed outside the ship. Tantalizing fragments came to him when O'Draid gave him glimpses of their predicament through her questions. Enough to offer new premises? Not without access to data that his console refused to display. It was his problem too, damn them. He was in a box, within their box, all of them trapped. O'Draid had stood beside this console one afternoon a week ago and blandly assured him the Sisterhood's data sources were opened wide to him. Right there she had stood, her back to the counter, leaning on it casually, arms folded across her breast. Her resemblance to the adult Miles Teg was uncanny at times. Even to that need, was it a compulsion to stand while talking? She disliked chair dogs too. He knew he had an extremely loose comprehension of her motives and plans, but he didn't trust them, not after Gamu. Decoy and bait, that was how they had used him. He was lucky not to have gone the way of Dune, a dead husk, used up by the Bene Gesserit. When he fidgeted this way, Idaho preferred to slump into the chair at his console. Sometimes he sat here for hours, immobile, his mind trying to encompass complexities of the ship's powerful data resources. The system could identify any human in it. So it has automatic monitors. It had to know who was speaking, making demands, assuming temporary command. Flight circuits defy my attempts to break through the locks. Disconnected? That was what his guards said.
but the ship's way of identifying who tapped the circuits, he knew his key lay there. Would Shiana help? It was a dangerous gamble to trust her too much. Sometimes when she watched him at his console, he was reminded of Adraid. Shiana was Adraid's student. That was a sobering memory. What was their interest in how he used ship systems, as if he needed to ask? During his third year here, he had made the system hide data for him, doing this with his own keys. To thwart the prying commies, he hid his actions in plain sight. Obvious insertions for later retrieval, but with an encrypted second message. Easy for a mentat and useful mostly as a trick, exploring the potential of ship systems. He had booby-trapped his data to a random dump without hope of recovery. Belonda suspected, but when she questioned him about it, he only smiled. I hide my history, Bill. My serial lives as a Gola. All of them back to the original non-Gola. Intimate things I remember about those experiences. A dumping ground for poignant memories. Sitting now at the console, he experienced mixed feelings. Confinement galled him. No matter the size and richness of his prison, it still was a prison. He had known for some time that he very likely could escape, but Nabella and his increasing knowledge about their predicament held him. He felt as much a prisoner of his thoughts as of the elaborate system represented by guards and this monstrous device. The no-ship was a device, of course, a tool, a way to move unseen in a dangerous universe, a means of concealing yourself and your intentions even from prescient searchers. With accumulated skills of many lifetimes, he looked on his surroundings through a screen of sophistication and naivete. Mentats cultivated naivete. Thinking you knew something was a sure way to blind yourself. It was not growing up that slowly applied brakes to learning, mentats were taught, but an accumulation of things I know. New data sources the Sisterhood had opened to him, if he could rely on them, raised questions. How was opposition to honored matres organized in the scattering? Obviously, they were groups, he hesitated to call them powers, who hunted honored matres the way honored matres hunted the Bene Gesserit, killed them too if you accepted Gamu evidence. Futars and handlers? He made a mentat projection. A Tleilaxu offshoot in the first scattering had engaged in genetic manipulations. Those two he saw in his vision, were they the ones who created futars? Could that couple be face dancers, independent of Tleilaxu masters? All was not singular in the scattering. Damn it. He needed access to more data, to potent sources. His present sources were not even remotely adequate. A tool of limited purpose, his console could be adapted to larger requirements, but his adaptations limped. He needed to stride out as a mentat. I've been hobbled, and that's a mistake. Doesn't Adraid trust me? She's an Atreides, damn her. She knows what I owe her family. More than one lifetime, and the debt never paid. He knew he was fidgeting. Abruptly, his mind locked on that. Mentat fidgeting. A signal that he stood poised at the edge of breakthrough. A prime projection. Something they had not told him about Teg? Questions. There were unasked questions lashing at him. I need perspective. Not necessarily a matter of distance. You could gain perspective from within if your questions carried few distortions. He sensed that somewhere in Bene Gesserit experiences, perhaps even in Bell's jealously guarded archives, lay missing pieces. Bell should appreciate this. A fellow mentat must know the excitement of this moment. His thoughts were like tesserae, most of the pieces at hand and ready to fit into a mosaic. It was not a matter of solutions. He could hear his first mentat teacher, the words rumbling in his mind. Assemble your questions in counterpoise and toss your temporary data onto one side of the scales or the other. Solutions unbalance any situation. Imbalances reveal what you seek. Yes, achieving imbalances with sensitized questions was a mentat's juggling act. Something Marbella had said the night before. What? They had been in bed. He recalled seeing the time projected on the ceiling, 9:47, and he had thought, that projection takes energy. He could almost feel the flow of the ship's power, this giant enclosure cut out of time. frictionless machinery to create a mimetic presence no instrument could distinguish from natural background, except for now when it was on standby, shielded not from eyes but from prescience. Mabella beside him, another kind of power, both aware of the force trying to pull them together, the energy it took to suppress that mutual magnetism, sexual attraction building and building and building. Mabella talking. Yes, that was it. Oddly self-analytic. She approached her own life with a new maturity, a Bene Gesserit heightened awareness and confidence that something of great strength grew in her. Every time he recognized this Bene Gesserit change, he felt sad. Nearer the day of our parting. But Mabella was talking. She, Audrade was often she, keeps asking me to assess my love for you. Remembering this, Idaho allowed it to replay. She has tried the same approach with me. What do you say? Odi et amo, excrucior. She lifted herself on one elbow and looked down at him. What language is that? A very old one Leto had me learn once. Translate. Peremptory. Her old honored matre self. I hate her, and I love her, and I am racked. Do you really hate me? Unbelieving. What I hate is being tied this way, not the master of myself. Would you leave me if you could? I want the decision to recur moment by moment. I want control of it. It's a game where one of the pieces can't be moved. There it was. Her words. Remembering, Idaho felt no elation, but as though his eyes had suddenly been opened after a long sleep. A game where one of the pieces can't be moved. Game. His view of the no-ship and what the sisterhood did here. There was more to the exchange. The ship is our own special school, Mabella said. He could only agree. The sisterhood reinforced his mentat capacities to screen data and display what had not gone through. He sensed where this might lead and felt leaden fear. You clear the nerve passages. You block off distractions and useless mind wanderings. You redirected your responses into that dangerous mode every mentat was warned to avoid. You can lose yourself there. Students were taken to see human vegetables. Failed mentats, kept alive to demonstrate the peril. How tempting, though. You could sense the power in that mode. Nothing hidden, all things known. In the midst of that fear, Mabella turning toward him on the bed, he felt the sexual tensions becoming almost explosive. Not yet, not yet. One of them had said something else. What? He had been thinking about the limits of logic as a tool to expose the sisterhood's motives. Do you often try to analyze them? Mabella asked. Uncanny how she did that, addressing his unspoken thoughts. She denied she read minds. I just read you, Gola, mine. You are mine, you know. And vice versa. Too true. Almost bantering, but it covered something deeper and convoluted. There was a pitfall in any analysis of human psyches, and he said this. Thinking you know why you behave as you do gives you all sorts of excuses for extraordinary behavior. Excuses for extraordinary behavior. There was another piece in his mosaic. More of the game, but these counters were guilt and blame. Mabella's voice was almost musing. I suppose you can rationalize almost anything by laying it on some trauma. Rationalize such things as burning entire planets? There is a kind of brutal self-determination in that. She says making determined choices firms up the psyche and gives you a sense of identity you can rely on under stress. Do you agree, mentat mine? The mentat is not yours. No force in his voice. Mabella laughed and slumped back onto her pillow. You know what these sisters want of us, mentat mine? They want our children. Oh, much more than that. They want our willing participation in their dream. Another piece of the mosaic. But who other than a Bene Gesserit knew that dream? The sisters were actresses, always performing, letting little that was real come through their masks. The real person was walled in and meted out as needed. Why does she keep that old painting? Mabella asked. Idaho felt his stomach muscles tighten. O'Drade had brought him a hollow record of the painting she kept in her sleeping chamber, Cottages at Cordeville by Vincent van Gogh, awakening him in this bed at some witching hour of the night almost a month ago.
You asked for my hold on humanity, and here it is,
thrusting the hollow in front of his sleep-fogged eyes. He sat up and stared at the thing, trying to comprehend. What was wrong with her? O'Drade sounded so excited. She left the hollow in his hands while she turned on all the lights, giving the room a sense of hard and immediate shapes, everything vaguely mechanical in the way you would expect it in a no-ship. Where was Mabella? They had gone to sleep together. He focused on the hollow, and it touched him in an unaccountable way, as though it linked him to O'Drade. Her hold on humanity? The hollow felt cold to his hands. She took it from him and propped it on the side table where he stared at it while she found a chair and sat near his head. Sitting? Something compelled her to be near him.
It was painted by a madman on old terror, she said,
bringing her cheek close to his while both looked at the copy of the painting.
Look at it. An encapsulated human moment.
In a landscape?
Yes, damn it, she was right.
He stared at the hollow.
Those marvelous colors.
It was not just the colors, it was the totality.
Most modern artists would laugh at the way he created that, O'Drade said.
Couldn't she be silent while he looked at it?
That was a human being as ultimate recorder, O'Drade said. The human hand, the human eye, the human essence brought to focus in the awareness of one person who tested the limits. Tested the limits.
More of the mosaic.
Van Gogh did that with the most primitive materials and equipment.
She sounded almost drunk.
Pigments a caveman would have recognized, painting on a fabric he could have made with his own hands. He might have made the tools himself, from fur and wild twigs.
She touched the surface of the hollow, her finger placing a shadow across the tall trees.
The cultural level was crude by our standards, but see what he produced.
Idaho felt he should say something, but words would not come. Where was Mabella? Why wasn't she here? O'Drade pulled back, and her next words burned themselves into him.
That painting says you cannot suppress the wild thing, the uniqueness that will occur among humans no matter how much we try to avoid it.
Idaho tore his gaze away from the hollow and looked at O'Drade's lips when she spoke.
Vincent told us something important about our fellows in the scattering.
This long-dead painter?
About the scattering? They have done things out there, and are doing things we cannot imagine. Wild things. The explosive side of that scattered population ensures it.
Mabella entered the room behind O'Drade, belting a soft white robe, her feet bare. Her hair was damp from a shower.
So that was where she had gone. Mother Superior?
Mabella's voice was sleepy. O'Drade spoke over her shoulder without fully turning.
Honored Matres think they can anticipate and control every wildness. What nonsense. They cannot even control it in themselves.
Mabella came around to the foot of the bed and stared questioningly at Idaho.
I seem to have come in on the middle of a conversation. Balance, that's the key, O'Drade said.
Idaho kept his attention on Mother Superior.
Humans can balance on strange surfaces, O'Drade said. Even on unpredictable ones, it's called getting in tune. Great musicians know it. Surfers I watched when I was a child on Gamu, they knew it. Some waves throw you, but you're prepared for that. You climb back up and go at it once more.
For no reason he could explain, Idaho thought of another thing O'Drade had said.
We have no attic storerooms. We recycle everything.
Recycle. Cycle. Pieces of the circle. Pieces of the mosaic. He was random hunting and knew better, not the Mentat way.
Recycle, though.
Other memory was not an attic storeroom then, but something they considered as recycling. It meant they used their past only to challenge it and renew it.
Getting in tune.
a strange allusion from someone who claimed she avoided music. Remembering, he sensed his mental mosaic. It had become a jumble, nothing fitted anywhere, random pieces that probably did not go together at all. But they did. Mother Superior's voice continued in his memory. So there is more. People who know this go to the heart of it, O'Drade said. They warn that you cannot think about what you're doing. That's a sure way to fail. You just do it.
Don't think. Do it.
He sensed anarchy. Her words threw him back onto resources other than Mentat training.
Bene Gesserit trickery.
She did this deliberately, knowing the effect. Where was the affection he sometimes felt radiating from her? Could she have concern for the well-being of someone she treated this way? When O'Drade left them, he barely noticed her departure, Mabella sat on the bed and straightened the robe around her knees.
Humans can balance on strange surfaces.
Movement in his mind, the pieces of the mosaic trying to find relationships. He felt a new surge in the universe. Those two strange people in his vision, they were a part of it. He knew this without being able to say why. What was it the Bene Gesserit claimed? We modify old fashions and old beliefs.
Look at me, Mabella said.
Voice? Not quite, but now he was sure she tried it on, and she had not told him they were training her in this witchery. He saw the alien look in her green eyes that told him she was thinking about her former associates.
Never try to be more clever than the Bene Gesserit, Duncan.
Speaking for the Comeyes?
He could not be sure. It was the intelligence behind her eyes that gripped him these days. He could feel it growing there, as though her teachers blew into a balloon and Mabella's intellect expanded the way her abdomen expanded with new life.
Voice? What were they doing to her?
That was a stupid question. He knew what they were doing. They were taking her away from him, making a sister of her.
No longer my lover, my marvelous Mabella.
A reverend mother, then, remotely calculating in everything she did. A witch. Who could love a witch?
I could, and always will.
They grab you from your blind side to use you for their own purposes, he said. He could see his words take hold. She had awakened to this trap after the fact. The Bene Gesserit were so damnably clever. They had enticed her into their trap, giving her small glimpses of things as magnetic as the force binding her to him. It could only be an enraging realization to an honored Matre.
We trap others, they do not trap us.
But this had been done by the Bene Gesserit. They were in a different category. Almost sisters. Why deny it? And she wanted their abilities. She wanted out of this probation into the full teaching she could sense just beyond the ship's walls. Didn't she know why they still kept her on probation?
They know she still struggles in their trap.
Mabella slipped out of her robe and climbed into the bed beside him, not touching, but keeping that armed sense of nearness between their bodies.
They originally intended me to control Shiana for them, he said. As you control me? Do I control you?
Sometimes I think you're a comic, Duncan.
If I can't laugh at myself, I'm really lost. Laugh at your pretensions to humor, too? Those first.
He turned toward her and cupped her left breast in his hand, feeling the nipple harden under his palm.
Did you know I was never weaned?
Never in all of those?
Not once.
I might have guessed.
A smile formed fleetingly on her lips, and abruptly both of them were laughing, clutching each other, helpless with it. Presently, Mabella said,
Damn! Damn! Damn!
Damn who?
As his laughter subsided, and they pulled apart, forcing the separation.
Not who? What? Damn fate?
I don't think fate cares.
I love you, and I'm not supposed to do that if I'm to be a proper reverend mother.
He hated these excursions, so close to self-pity.
Joke, then. You've never been a proper anything.
He massaged the pregnant swelling of her abdomen.
I am proper.
That's a word they left out when they made you.
She pushed his hand away and sat up to look down at him.
Reverend mothers are never supposed to love.
I know that.
Did my anguish reveal itself?
She was too caught up in her own worries.
When I get to the spice agony...
Love, I don't like the idea of agony associated with you in any way.
How can I avoid it? I'm already in the chute. Very soon they'll have me up to speed. I'll go very fast then.
He wanted to turn away, but her eyes held him.
Truly, Duncan, I can feel it. In a way, it's like pregnancy. There comes a point when it's too dangerous to abort. You must go through with it.
So we love each other, forcing his thoughts away from one danger into another.
And they forbid it.
He looked up at the comm eyes. The watchdogs are watching us, and they have fangs.
I know. I'm talking to them right now. My love for you is not a flaw. Their coldness is the flaw. They're just like honored matres.
A game where one of the pieces can't be moved. He wanted to shout it, but listeners behind the comm eyes would hear more than spoken words. Mabella was right. It was dangerous to think you could gull reverend mothers. Something veiled in her eyes as she looked down at him. How very strange you looked just then. He recognized the reverend mother she might become.
Veer away from that thought.
Thinking about the strangeness of his memories sometimes diverted her. She thought his previous incarnations made him somehow similar to a reverend mother.
I've died so many times. You remember it?
The same question every time. He shook his head, not daring to say anything more for the watchdogs to interpret.
Not the deaths and reawakenings.
Those became dulled by repetition. Sometimes he didn't even bother to put them into his secret data dump. No. It was the unique encounters with other humans, the long collection of recognitions. That was a thing Shiana claimed she wanted from him.
Intimate trivia. It's the stuff all artists want.
Shiana did not know what she asked. All of those living encounters had created new meanings, patterns within patterns. Minuscule things gained a poignancy he despaired of sharing with anyone, even with Mabella. The touch of a hand on my arm. A child's laughing face. The glitter in an attacker's eyes. Mundane things without counting. A familiar voice saying, I just want to put my feet up and collapse tonight. Don't ask me to move. All had become part of him. They were bound into his character. Living had cemented them inextricably, and he could not explain it to anyone. Mabella spoke without looking at him.
There were many women in those lives of yours.
I've never counted them.
Did you love them?
They're dead, Mabella. All I can promise is that there are no jealous ghosts in my past. Mabella extinguished the glow globes. He closed his eyes and felt darkness close in as she crept into his arms. He held her tightly, knowing she needed it, but his mind rolled of its own volition. An old memory produced a Mentat teacher's saying, "The greatest relevancy can become irrelevant in the space of a heartbeat. Mentats should look upon such moments with joy." He felt no joy. All of those serial lives continued within him in defiance of Mentat relevances. A Mentat came at his universe fresh in each instant, nothing old, nothing new, nothing set in ancient adhesives, nothing truly known. You were the net, and you existed only to examine the catch. What did not go through? How fine a mesh did I use on this lot? That was the Mentat view. But there was no way that Leilaxu could have included all of those Gola Idaho cells to recreate him. There had to be gaps in their serial collection of his cells. He had identified many of those gaps.
But no gaps in my memory. I remember them all.
He was a network linked outside of time. That is how I can see the people of that vision. The net. It was the only explanation Mentat awareness could provide, and if the Sisterhood guessed, they would be terrified. No matter how many times he denied it, they would say, "Another Kwisatz Haderach, kill him!"
So work for yourself, Mentat.
He knew he had most of the mosaic pieces, but still they did not go together in that aha assembly of questions Mentat prized. A game where one of the pieces can't be moved. Excuses for extraordinary behavior. They want our willing participation in their dream. Test the limits. Humans can balance on strange surfaces.
Get in tune.
Don't think. Do it.
The best art imitates life in a compelling way. If it imitates a dream, it must be a dream of life. Otherwise, there is no place where we can connect. Our plugs don't fit. Dawi O'Drade. As they travelled south toward the desert in the early afternoon, O'Drade found the countryside disturbingly changed from her previous inspection 3 months earlier. She felt vindicated in having chosen ground vehicles. Views framed by the thick plaz protecting them from the dust revealed more details at this level.
Much drier.
Her immediate party rode in a relatively light car, only 15 passengers, including the driver. Suspensors and sophisticated jet drive when they were not on ground effect, capable of a smooth 300 clicks an hour on the glaze. Her escort, too large thanks to an overzealous Tamerlane, followed in a bus that also carried changes of clothing, foods and drinks for wayside stops. Streggy, seated behind O'Drade and behind the driver, said,
"Could we not manage a small rain here, Mother Superior?"
O'Drade's lips thinned. Silence was the best answer. They had been late starting, all of them assembled on the loading dock, and were ready to leave when a message came down from Belonda. Another disaster report requiring Mother Superior's personal attention at the last minute. It was one of those times when O'Drade felt her only possible role was that of official interpreter. Walk to the edge of the stage and tell them what it meant.
"Today, sisters, we learned that honored Matres have obliterated 4 more of our planets. We are that much smaller. Only 12 planets, including Boozal, and the faceless hunter with the axe is that much closer."
O'Drade felt the chasm yawning beneath her. Belonda had been ordered to contain this latest bad news until a more appropriate moment. O'Drade looked out the window beside her. What was an appropriate moment for such news? They had been driving south a little more than 3 hours, the burner glazed roadway like a green river ahead of them. This passage led them through hillsides of cork oaks that stretched out to ridge-enclosed horizons. The oaks had been allowed to grow gnome-like in less regimented plantations than orchards. There were meandering rows up the hills. The original plantation had been laid out on existing contours, semi-terraces now obscured by long brown grass.
"We grow truffles in there," O'Drade said.
Streggy had more bad news.
"I'm told the truffles are in trouble, Mother Superior. Not enough rain."
"No more truffles?"
O'Drade hesitated on the edge of bringing a communications acolyte from the rear and asking whether if this dryness could be corrected. She glanced back at her attendants. 3 rows, 4 people in each row, specialists to extend her observational powers and carry out orders. And look at that bus following them. One of the larger such vehicles on Chapter House, 30 meters long at least, crammed with people, dust whirled across and around it. Tamerlane rode back there at O'Drade's orders. Mother Superior could be peppery when aroused, everyone thought. Tam had brought too many people, but O'Drade had discovered it too late for changes.
"Not an inspection, a damned invasion."
"Follow my lead, Tam. A little political drama. Make transition easier."
She returned her attention to the driver, only male in this car. Clearby, a vinegary little transport expert, pinched-up face, skin the colour of newly turned damp earth. O'Drade's favourite driver, fast, safe, and wary of limits of his machine. They crested a hill and cork oaks thinned out, replaced ahead by fruit orchards surrounding a community. Beautiful in this light, O'Drade thought. Low buildings of white walls and orange-tiled roofs. An arch-shaded entrance street could be seen far down the slope, and in a line behind it, the tall central structure containing regional overview offices. The sight reassured O'Drade. The community had a glowing look softened by distance and a haze rising from its ring orchards. Branches still bare up here in this winter belt, but surely capable of at least one more crop. The sisterhood demanded a certain beauty in its surroundings, she reminded herself, a cosseting that provided support for the senses without subtracting from needs of the stomach. Comfort where possible, but not too much. Someone behind Odraid said,
I do believe some of these trees are starting to leaf.
Odraid took a more careful look. Yes, tiny bits of green on dark boughs. Winter had slipped here. Weather control, struggling to make seasonal shifts, could not prevent occasional mistakes. The expanding desert was creating higher temperatures too early here. Odd warming patches that caused plants to leaf or bloom just in time for an abrupt frost. Dieback of plantations was becoming much too common. A field advisor had dredged up the ancient term Indian summer for a report illustrated by projections of an orchard in full blossom being assaulted by snow. Odraid had felt memory stirring at the advisor's words. Indian summer. How appropriate. Her counselors, sharing that little view of their planet's travail, recognized the metaphor of a marauding freeze coming on the heels of inappropriate warmth. An unexpected revival of warm weather, a time when raiders could plague their neighbors. Remembering, Odraid felt the chill of the hunter's axe. How soon? She dared not seek the answer. I'm not a Kwisatz Haderach. Without turning, Odraid spoke to Stregi. This place, Pondreel, have you ever been here?
It was not my postulant center, Mother Superior, but I presume it is similar.
Yes, these communities were much alike, mostly low structures set in garden plots and orchards, school centers for specific training. It was a screening system for prospective sisters, the mesh finer the closer you got to Central. Some of these communities, such as Pondreel, concentrated on toughening their charges. They sent women out for long hours every day to manual labor. Hands that grubbed in dirt and became stained with fruit seldom balked at muckier tasks later in life. Now that they were out of the dust, Clerby opened the windows. Heat poured in. What was weather doing? Two buildings at the edge of Pondreel had been joined one story above the street, forming a long tunnel. All it needed, Odraid thought, was a portcullis to duplicate a town gate out of pre-space history. Armored knights would not find the dusky heat of this entry unfamiliar. It was defined in dark plastone, visually identical to stone. Comi apertures overhead surely were places where guardians lay in wait. The long, shaded entry to the community was clean, she saw. Nostrils were seldom assailed by rot or other offensive odors in Bene Gesserit communities. No slums, few cripples hobbling along the walks, much healthy flesh. Good management took care to keep a healthy population happy.
We have our disabled, though, and not all of them physically disabled.
Clerby parked just within the exit from the shaded street, and they emerged. Tamerlane's bus pulled to a stop behind them. Odraid had hoped the entry passage would provide relief from the heat, but perversity of nature had made an oven of the place, and the temperature actually increased here. She was glad to pass through into the clear light of the central square, where sweat burning off her body provided a few seconds of coolness. The illusion of relief passed abruptly as the sun scorched her head and shoulders. She was forced to call on metabolic control to adjust her body heat. Water splashed in a reflecting circle at the central square, a careless display that soon would have to end.
Leave it for now. Morale!
She heard her companions following, the usual groans against sitting too long in one position. A greeting delegation could be seen hurrying from the far side of the square. Odraid recognized Tsimpe, Pondreel's leader, in the van. Mother Superior's attendants moved onto the blue tiles of the fountain plaza, all except Stregi, who stood at Odraid's shoulder. Tamerlane's group, too, was attracted to splashing water, all part and parcel of a human dream so ancient it could never be completely discarded, Odraid thought.
Fertile fields and open water. Clear, potable water you can dip your face into for thirst-quenching relief.
Indeed, some of her party were doing just that at the fountain. Their faces glistened with dampness. The Pondreel delegation came to a stop near Odraid while still on the blue tiles of the fountain plaza. Tsimpe had brought two other reverend mothers and five older acolytes. Near the agony, all of those acolytes, Odraid observed, showing their awareness of the trial in directness of gaze. Tsimpe was someone Odraide saw infrequently at Central, where she came sometimes as a teacher. She was looking fit, brown hair so dark it appeared reddish-black in this light. The narrow face was almost bleak in its austerity, her features centered on all blue eyes under heavy brows.
"We are glad to see you, Mother Superior," sounded as though she meant it.
Odraide inclined her head, a minimal gesture.
"I hear you. Why are you so glad to see me?"
Tsimpe understood. She gestured to a tall, hollow-cheeked Reverend Mother beside her.
"You remember Fali, our orchard mistress? Fali has just been to me with a delegation of gardeners. A serious complaint."
Fali's weathered face looked a bit grey.
"Overworked?"
She had a thin mouth above a sharp chin, dirt under her fingernails. Odraide noted it with approval.
"Not afraid to join in the grubbing." Delegation of gardeners.
So there was an escalation of complaints. Must have been serious. Not like Tsimpe to dump it on Mother Superior.
"Let's hear it," Odraide said.
With a glance at Tsimpe, Fali went through a detailed recital, even providing qualifications of delegation leaders, all of them good people, of course. Odraide recognized the pattern. There had been conferences concerning this inevitable consequence, Tsimpe in attendance at some of them. How could you explain to your people that a distant sandworm, perhaps not even in existence yet, required this change? How could you explain to farmers that it was not a matter of just a bit more rain, but went straight to the heart of the planet's total weather? More rain here could mean a diversion of high-altitude winds. That in its turn would change things elsewhere, cause moisture-laden siroccos where they would be not only upsetting but also dangerous. Too easy to bring on great tornadoes if you inserted the wrong conditions. A planet's weather was no simple thing to treat with easy adjustments,
as I have sometimes demanded.
Each time there was a total equation to be scanned.
"The planet casts the final vote," Odraide said.
It was an old reminder in the sisterhood of human fallibility.
"Does Dune still have a vote?"
Fali asked, more bitterness in the question than Odraide had anticipated.
"I feel the heat. We saw the leaves on your orchards as we arrived," Odraide said. "I know what concerns you, sister."
"We will lose part of the crop this year," Fali said.
Accusation in her words, "This is your fault."
"What did you tell your delegation?" Odraide asked.
"That the desert must grow and weather no longer can make every adjustment we need."
Truth. The agreed response. Inadequate, as truth often was, but all they had now. Something would have to give soon. Meanwhile, more delegations and loss of crops.
"Will you take tea with us, Mother Superior?"
Tsimpe, the diplomat, intervening. "You see how it is escalating, Mother Superior? Fali will now go back to dealing with fruits and vegetables, her proper place. Message delivered."
Sregi cleared her throat.
"That damnable gesture will have to be suppressed."
But the meaning was clear. Sregi had been put in charge of their schedule.
"We must be going." "We got a late start," Odraide said. "We stopped only to stretch our legs and see if you have problems you cannot meet on your own."
"We can handle the gardeners, Mother Superior."
Tsimpe's brisk tone said much more, and Odraide almost smiled.
"Inspect if you wish, Mother Superior. Look anywhere. You will find Pondreal in Bene Gesserit order."
Odraide glanced at Tamerlane's bus. Some of the people already were returning to the air-conditioned interior. Tamerlane stood by the door, well within earshot.
"I hear good reports of you, Tsimpe," Odraide said. "You can do without our interference. I certainly don't want to intrude on you with an entourage that is far too large."
This last, loud enough that all would be certain to hear.
"Where will you spend the night, Mother Superior?"
"El Dio.
I've not been down there for some time, but I hear the sea is much smaller."
"Overflights confirm what you've heard. No need to warn them that we're coming, Tsimpe. They already know. We had to prepare them for this invasion."
Orchard Mistress Fali took a small step forward.
"Mother Superior, if we could just..."
"Tell your gardeners, Fali, that they have a choice. They can grumble and wait here until honored matres arrive to enslave them, or they can elect to go scattering."
Odraid returned to her car and sat, eyes closed, until she heard the doors sealed and they were well on their way. Presently she opened her eyes. They already were out of Pondreal and into the glassy lane through the southern ring orchards. There was charged silence behind her. Sisters were looking deeply into questions about Mother Superior's behaviour back there. An unsatisfactory encounter. Acolytes naturally picked up the mood. Sregi looked glum. This weather demanded notice. Words no longer could smooth over the complaints. Good days were measured by lower standards. Everyone knew the reason, but changes remained a focal point. Visible. You could not complain about Mother Superior, not without good cause, but you could grumble about the weather. Why did they have to make it so cold today? Why today, when I have to be out in it? Quite warm when we came out, but look at it now, and me without proper clothing. Streggy wanted to talk. Well, that's why I brought her. But she had become almost garrulous, as enforced intimacy eroded her awe of Mother Superior.
Mother Superior, I've been searching in my manuals for an explanation of
beware of manuals. How many times in her life had she heard or spoken those words? Manuals create habits. Streggy had been lectured often about habits. The Bene Gesserit had them, those things the folk preserved as typical of the witches, but patterns that allowed others to predict behaviour, those must be carefully excised.
Then why do we have manuals, Mother Superior?
We have them mainly to disprove them. The coda is for novices and others in primary training.
And the histories?
Never ignore the banality of recorded histories. As a reverend mother, you will relearn history in each new moment.
Truth is an empty cup.
Very proud of her remembered aphorism. Odraid almost smiled. Streggy is a jewel. It was a cautioning thought. Some precious stones could be identified by their impurities. Experts mapped impurities within the stones, a secret fingerprint. People were like that. You often knew them by their defects. The glittering surface told you too little. Good identification required you to look deep inside and see the impurities. There was the gem quality of a total being. What would Van Gogh have been without impurities? It is comments of perceptive cynics, Streggy, things they say about history that should be your guides before the agony. Afterward, you will be your own cynic and you will discover your own values. For now, the histories reveal dates and tell you something occurred. Reverend mothers search out the somethings and learn the prejudices of historians.
That's all?
Deeply offended. Why did they waste my time that way? Many histories are largely worthless because prejudiced, written to please one powerful group or another. Wait for your eyes to be opened, my dear. We are the best historians. We were there.
And my viewpoint will change daily?
Very introspective. That's a lesson the Basha reminded us to keep fresh in our minds. The past must be reinterpreted by the present.
I'm not sure I will enjoy that, Mother Superior. So many moral decisions.
Ah, this jewel saw to the heart of it and spoke her mind like a true Bene Gesserit. There were brilliant facets among Streggy's impurities. Odraid looked sideways at the pensive acolyte. Long ago, the sisterhood had ruled that each sister must make her own moral decisions. Never follow a leader without asking your own questions. That was why moral conditioning of the young took such high priority. That is why we like to get our prospective sisters so young. And it may be why a moral flaw has crept into Shiana. We got her too late. What do she and Duncan talk about so secretly with their hands? Moral decisions are always easy to recognize, Odraid said. They are where you abandon self-interest. Streggy looked at Odraid with awe.
The courage it must take.
Not courage, not even desperation. What we do is, in its most basic sense, natural. Things done because there is no other choice.
Sometimes you make me feel ignorant, Mother Superior.
Excellent. That's beginning wisdom. There are many kinds of ignorance, Streggy. The basest is to follow your own desires without examining them. Sometimes we do it unconsciously. Hone your sensitivity. Be aware of what you do unconsciously. Always ask,
When I did that, what was I trying to gain?
They crested the final hill before Eldio, and Odraid welcomed a reflexive moment. Someone behind her murmured, "There's the sea."
"Stop here,"
Odraid ordered as they neared a wide turnout at a curve overlooking the sea. Clebby knew the place and was prepared for it. Odraid often asked him to stop here. He brought them to a halt where she wanted. The car creaked as it settled. They heard the bus pull up behind, a loud voice back there calling on companions to
look at that.
Eldio lay off to Odraid's left, far down there. Delicate buildings, some raised off the ground on slender pipes, wind passing under and through them. This was far enough south and down off the heights where Central perched that it was much warmer. Small, vertical axis windmills, toys from this distance, whirled at the corners of Eldio's buildings to help power the community. Odraid pointed them out to Streggy.
"We thought of them as independents from bondage to a complex technology controlled by others."
As she spoke, Odraid shifted her attention to the right.
The sea.
It was a dreadfully condensed remnant of its once glorious expanse. Sea Child hated what she saw. Warm vapor lifted from the sea. The dim purple of dry hills drew a blurred outline of horizon on the far side of the water. She saw that weather had introduced a wind to disperse saturated air. The result was a choppy froth of waves beating against the shingle below this vantage. There had been a string of fishing villages here, Odraid recalled. Now that the sea had receded, villages lay farther back up the slope. Once the villages had been a colourful accent along the shore. Much of their population had been siphoned off in the new scattering. People who remained had built a tram to get their boats to and from the water. She approved of this and deplored it. Energy conservation. The whole situation struck her suddenly as grim, like one of those old Empire geriatric installations where people waited around to die.
How long until these places die?
The sea is so small!
It was a voice from the rear of the car. Odraid recognized it, an archives clerk.
One of Bell's damned spies.
Leaning forward, Odraid tapped Clareby on the shoulder.
Take us down to the near shore. That cove almost directly below us. I wish to swim in our sea, Clareby, while it still exists.
Streggy and two other acolytes joined her in the warm waters of the cove. The others walked along the shore or watched this odd scene from the car and bus.
Mother Superior swimming nude in the sea.
Odraid felt energizing water around her. Swimming was required because of command decisions she must make. How much of this last great sea could they afford to maintain during these final days of their planet's temperate life? The desert was coming. Total desert to match that of Lost Dune.
If the Axe-Bearer gives us time.
The threat felt very close, and the chasm deep.
Damn this wild talent. Why do I have to know?
Slowly, Sea Child and wave motions restored her sense of balance. This body of water was a major complication, much more important than scattered small seas and lakes. Moisture lifted from here in significant amounts, energy to charge unwanted deviations in weather's barely controlled management. Yet this sea still fed Chapter House. It was a communication and transport route. Sea carriers were cheapest. Energy costs must be balanced against other elements in her decision. But the sea would vanish, that was sure. Whole populations faced new displacements. Sea Child's memories interfered. Nostalgia. It blocked paths of proper judgment.
How fast must the sea go?
That was the question. All of the inevitable relocations and resettlements waited on that decision.
Best it were done quickly. The pain banished into our past. Let us get on with it.
She swam to the shallows and looked up at the puzzled Tamerlane. Tam's robed skirts were dark with splashings from an unexpected wave. Odraid lifted her head clear of the small surges.
Tam, eliminate the sea as fast as possible. Get weather to plot a swift dehydration scheme. Food and transport will have to be brought into it. I'll approve the final plan after our usual review.
Tamerlane turned away without speaking. She beckoned appropriate sisters to accompany her, glancing only once at Mother Superior as she did this.
See, I was right to bring along the necessary cadre.
Odraid climbed from the water, wet sand gritted under her feet.
Soon it will be dry sand.
She dressed without bothering to towel herself. Clothing gripped her flesh uncomfortably, but she ignored this, walking up the strand away from the others, not looking back at the sea.
Souvenirs of memory must be only that. Things to be taken up and fondled occasionally for evocation of past joys. No joy can be permanent. All is transient. This, too, shall pass away, applies to all of our living universe.
Where the beach became loamy dirt and a few sparse plants, she turned finally and looked back at the sea she had just condemned. Only life itself mattered, she told herself, and life could not endure without an ongoing thrust of procreation.
Survival. Our children must survive. The Bene Gesserit must survive.
No single child was more important than the totality. She accepted this, recognizing it as the species talking to her from her deepest self, the self she had first encountered as Sea Child. Odraid allowed Sea Child one last sniff of salt air as they returned to their vehicles and prepared to drive into Eldio. She felt herself grow calm. That essential balance, once learned, did not require a sea to maintain it. Uproot your questions from their ground and the dangling roots will be seen. More questions. Mentat Zen Sufi.
Dharma was in her element. Spider Queen. She liked the witch's title for her. This was the heart of her web, this new control center on Junction. The exterior of the building still did not suit her. Too much guild complacency in its design, conservative. But the interior had begun to take on a familiarity that soothed her. She could almost imagine she had never left Dur, that there had been no futars on the harrowing flight back into the old empire. She stood in the open door of the assembly room, looking out at the botanical garden. Lonyu waited 4 paces behind. Not too close behind me, Lonyo, or I shall have to kill you. There was still dew on the lawn beyond the tiles where, when the sun had risen far enough, servants would distribute comfortable chairs and tables. She had ordered a sunny day, and weather had damned well better produce it. Lonyo's port was interesting. So the old witch had returned to Boozle, and she was angry too. Excellent. Obviously, she knew she was being watched, and she had visited her supreme witch to ask for removal from Boozle for sanctuary, and she had been refused. They don't care that we destroy their limbs, just as long as the central body remains hidden. Speaking over her shoulder to Lonyo, Dharma said, "Bring that old witch to me, and all of her attendants." As Lonyo turned to obey, Dharma added, "And begin starving some futars. I want them hungry." "Yes, Dharma." Someone else moved into Lonyo's attendant position. Dharma did not turn to identify the replacement. There were always enough aides to carry out necessary orders. One was much like another, except in the matter of threat. Lonyo was a constant threat. Keeps